The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
I'm never not talking about Milton. I hereby pledge to you to maximize the appropriateness and minimize the number of sorority girl jokes. I'm sorry, I'm an ironist in a target-rich environment. And I'm quite sure that none of the folks at ACCS had any idea, nor did the darling Phi Beta Gamma girls, all 9,748 of them, plus their den mothers and all the other ladies. But you know that someone at the hotel booking office was busting a gut. Hey, look at this! Look at this! This is going to be fun, man. Put on the popcorn. I did ride an elevator with one of these sweet young ladies the other day. She was really, really darling, although she was under the impression that Cum Laude was a gospel song. And then, absolutely by accident the other day, I wandered into one of their meetings, and I thought, I'm just going for it. So I started campaigning and arguing and debating for who I was going to vote for, and and then after about 20 minutes, you know, they figured out what was going on. I was surrounded by this gigantic Amazonian pink-clad, high-heeled, estrogenic circle who were asking me, why are you here? What are you doing? Don't you know what this is? What is an old man doing at a sorority convention? I told him I was in from L.A. and I currently identified as a sorority girl. And if their question is bigoted and intolerant and so grounded in absolute reality that I was deeply unsafe and offended. And so they elected me chairwoman of Phi Beta Gamma. Now I'm here. So as soon as I finish here, I got to go over and wrap that up. being a last day speaker is a hard job, especially if you've spoken a couple of times. Because your audience is tired, they're worn out, they're over stuff like person with no self-control at a sushi buffet. And I'm going to try and keep this fairly simple and direct and not long, but you will need to pray for N.D. Wilson because he's kind of going to anchor the whole ship here and close this off. I want to, first of all, encourage you, especially new schools. I want to encourage you because what you're doing is a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing, what you're doing. This movement has grown, and it continues to grow in good ways. It appears to me to be healthy and strong and joy-filled. it's kind of almost like a small reformation in a certain way in the church. Remember, you're doing a certain kind of pastoral ministerial work, right? You're forming souls. Do not forget that. You're forming souls. You're not making lesson plans and teaching Latin and administering and solving problems and dealing with parents and tuition going up and things like that. You're forming souls. It's very pastoral. And I love coming to something like this, or all the schools that I visit all over the country on a regular basis, and seeing this beautiful example of basic Christianity where there's Christian unity without doctrinal compromise. It's just a beautiful thing to see, and I'm so thrilled for that. On the other hand, I'm a little sad because even though I'm a Virginia boy translated to Los Angeles, that's like my foreign mission service for the last 17 years. The Southern California area is not that large geographically, but There's a lot of people there. I live on the far north side of Los Angeles County in the mountains, a little beautiful valley just outside of the LA city sprawl. I kind of back up in a private canyon up to the National Forest. So it's very idyllic and very pretty. But between me, Los Padres National Forest, and the border of Mexico, the south side of San Diego, which would only take about 2 hours to drive. There's no traffic, but it normally takes about 3 weeks to get down there. Between where I live and the southern border of Southern California are 35 million people. 35 million people. One out of 10 people in America live within 2 or 3 hours of where I live. Just going south. 35 million people. And we have a tiny handful of classical Christian schools. You know, two or three that have some size and have been going for a little while, and a couple of that are kind of in their earlier years. And I tell people all the time, yeah, we started one, and after a year or two or four it just collapsed. It's a very, very difficult place culturally and economically to start one of these kinds of schools. And my dream is to see and perhaps in some way to facilitate 10 of these schools starting up in the next decade. I know that sounds insane, but I'd like to do it. I'm already talking with a couple of pastors and a couple of people that want to do that. And I would like to ask you to be just joining with me in prayer for God to raise these schools up. 10 minutes south of where I live, there's a place called Hollywood, and these people are the culture producers of the entire planet. Do you understand? Everybody gets everything they think about everything. We're going to get to Milton in a little while, trust me, Dave. Everybody in the world thinks everything they think about everything based upon what Hollywood tells them to think. And we need more of these kinds of schools in Southern California. So I'm going to ask you to be praying for me with that. And let me bring this up as well before we really, really get into the talk. How many of you have had any difficulty at any point in your journey along the road of working in classical Christian education? One hands, two hands, yeah. There. Yeah, yeah. The difficulties are manifold. They're everywhere. It almost seems like a constant stream. But as the pilot told the junior bombardier in World War II while flying over Germany, when a young man freaked out because things were exploding all around the plane all of a sudden one night, he said, "Son, if you're getting flak, you're over the target. If you're getting flak, it means you're over the target. You fly into the flak, and you do what you need to do." Now, the last two talks that I did set help to set this up. So if you were in either or both of those, you'll understand what's going on. The rest of you will be completely clueless, which is how I often feel about myself in the midst of my own talks. I'm going to talk to you today about something that I am calling Pele Aletheia. My Alcuin fellow brother and friend, Steve Turley, who's been here speaking at the conference, said, "Ooh, I saw your title. Now you're coining terms." Yeah, I slapped him around a little bit. He's a very obnoxious guy. And so I have this term that I like to use, Pele Aletheia. It makes you sound much smarter than you are. Oh, yeah, Pele Aletheia. Yes. Don't know what it means. It sounds kind of Greek-y or something like that. And I want to talk to you about Pele Aletheia. It's made up of three parts from classical languages, of course. Lethe, which is, of course, the river of forgetfulness in the underworld. We see in Aeneid Book 6. You drink from River Lethe, and you forget. What do you forget? I don't know, I forgot. You forget everything, right? You drink from the River Lethe, and you forget, and then you can be reincarnated and come back into the world, all right? And the middle there, the A, the alpha, is a negating prefix. Aletheia means not forgetting, or to not forget, right? Aletheia, by the way, is the classical Greek word for truth. Truth means not forgetting. Truth means remembering. That's what I did my first talk on the other day. And then Pele is this Greek root which has the idea of making something. Like a poet was a maker of worlds. Right? Homer was a poet. He was a creator of worlds. So poe aletheia means making the not forgetting. It means making the not forgetting. Or if you like good music, just think Nat King Cole. It's unforgettable. Right? That's what poe aletheia means. And in a certain sense, poe aletheia means making the truth. Now, we don't per se make the truth. That is God's job. But our problem with the truth is what? What's our problem with the truth? We forget it. The whole Old Testament, the whole entire Old Testament is grounded in one idea. Remember. Do not forget. Remember. And that is what our task is. To make the not forgetting. Do not forget. Our task is poe aletheia. When we work with our students, it is poe aletheia. To make the not forgetting. If you want to be a teacher, you want to be a good teacher, you have to be unforgettable by presenting things that are unforgettable. That's what you need to do. Now, memory is a very interesting and important thing. In the medieval world, they had what they called the Ars Memoria, right? The art of memory. And they had all these incredibly beautiful, complex systems, visual systems, many of them like the castle of memory, where you would build a castle in your mind and you would populate the rooms with all the parts of your oration and you would memorize a walk through the castle. They had the garden of memory. You would plant the plants of your ideas in the garden and you would walk and amble through the garden while you're up in front of people. And it would help you remember all the parts of your speech. Right? And those of you who have done any acting, you know the hard work of learning your lines, right? It's a very, very powerful thing, memory. It's a very important part of culture. Culture is preserved because of memory. Probably the greatest literary work of all time is in many ways grounded around the image and the power of memory. You remember in the scene in Hamlet where Hamlet Jr. meets the ghost of his father, apparently the ghost of his father, right? And the ghost says to his son, "I have been murdered. Go, you know, murder your uncle. Don't hurt your mother, you know, who married, you know, the uncle, this incestuous, adulterate beast." But, and then what does he say? As he fades off, as the sun comes up, he says, "Remember me." Just like that. Remember me. Because when you're a ghost, you don't say, "Hey, remember me." Oh, sure, Dad, not a problem. Wait, I thought you were dead. There's a great deal of evidence, in fact, that Shakespeare, who is not just owner of Globe Theater and playwright, is also an actor, that Shakespeare himself played the ghost in the earliest productions of Hamlet, which is kind of, you know, he must have loved writing those lines. "Remember me." You know, Shakespeare's at the breakfast table. "I'm working on getting my lines." And his wife says, "What is the line? Remember me." "Yeah, you better remember your lines, because they go out and your line is remember me, and you forget, it's going to be really foolish." And then Hamlet, the son that's being prompted to revenge, greatest literary character of all time, Harold Bloom, Yale critic, been teaching here about 56 years, says, "Hamlet is the only literary character intelligent enough to have written the work in which he appears." Hamlet says, "Remember thee." He's just met his dad's murdered ghost. "Remember thee, aye, thou poor ghost, while memory holds a seat to this distracted globe. Remember thee. Yes, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all bond, trivial records, all souls of books, all forms, all pressures past that youth and observation copied there. And thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter." This is a little picture of pedagogy in the 16th century. Do you realize that? When you're young, you press, you use pressure, it's like a printing press or a wax seal, a signet seal. You press these things into your memory, all the saws and all the books, all the old sayings. Commonplace book is what he's referring to here. Right. He says, "I'm going to remember nothing but you and your call to revenge. Thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain." Wouldn't it be great if Christians could say that like Hamlet? "The only thing I will remember is your commandment, unmixed with face or matter." Think about all the times that memory is mentioned in the play Hamlet, that it becomes part of the plot, right? Claudius at the beginning of the play, "Of Hamlet, our dear brothers, death though the memory be green." Yeah, I murdered a guy, but you guys don't know that. The ghost says, "Adieu, adieu, adieu, remember me." Hamlet, after his conversation with the ghost, says, my tables, meet it as I set it down. The tables are the commonplace book, where he collects all of his favorite quotes. Could you imagine you're flipping through his commonplace book as a quote from Dead Dad, right? Written down in his commonplace book there. How about poor, sad, mad, beautiful Ophelia? There's Rosemary, that's for remembrance. She's just, you know, bought the farm and, you know, handing out sticks to people as if they're flowers. And Rosemary was identified with making your memory work a little bit better. I don't think that happens. It's pretty good in spaghetti, though. And then at the end of the play, this non-character, Fortinbras, this, you know, son of the king of Norway, is also killed. The story is about three people whose fathers have been killed, right? Fortinbras and Hamlet Sr. And then Laertes' father. But Fortinbras comes in at the end of the play. This is a nobody character. He's just kind of a mop-up character, one of the end of the Shakespeare play characters. Some guy you don't know comes in. Well, that's the end of the play. All right, let's all remember. And so Fortinbras comes in and he says, let us haste to hear it. Right, Horatio's story of Hamlet, and call the noblest audience. Let's hear it. Let's remember it. And then, of course, everyone's favorite character in Shakespeare's Hamlet, the lovable, sweet, briefly speaking, Polonius. Right. He says, brevity is the soul of wit, and launches on for about 9 pages of little proverbs, very pedantic. And he says to Laertes, in these few precepts in thy memory, look thou character. Character, we would say character now, means write it down in the table of your memory. Remember all these little wise sayings that I have for you. But this idea of writing something down to remember it, that's our word character. Because your memory is your character. What you put in your head and what you store in your head, that is, it becomes your character. There's no doubt about it. Memory is crucial to Hamlet. Actors in the 16th and the 17th century were generally repertory actors, which means they would either be at a local theater or they would travel around. And they did not go, well, let's do Hamlet this season. And then they'd memorize their part in Hamlet, and then they'd be off for 6 months. Starving, waiting tables, all those kinds of things. Right. No. They generally put on 4 to 6 plays a week, different plays, and most of them had 2 to 4 parts. This is why in Shakespeare, many characters don't show up. They never meet on stage because they're actually played by a different actor in a different costume. Do you imagine memorizing maybe 8 or 10 Shakespeare parts and performing them in 1 week? Shakespeare knew that our worlds were created by memory. Your conscious mind is, in fact, the sum of your present conscious awareness of 4 things. Your conscious mind, your self-present conscious mind, is the sum of your present conscious, your moment-by-moment consciousness or awareness of 4 different things. Number 1, your accessible memories. Remember what you had for breakfast, you remember your grandmother's maiden name, those kinds of things. Number 2, your curiosity about the future. Number 3, your awareness of the present moment. Boy, these lights are bright. If I stare at them, I won't see you and I'll walk off the edge of the podium. It'll be really funny and Andy Wilson will get an extra 40 minutes to talk. Probably better for you. And then number 4, your awareness of your awareness of this moment. Right? Your accessible memories, your curiosity about the future, your awareness of this present moment, and then also kind of self-reflexively, your awareness of your awareness of this moment, especially if you happen to be Immanuel Kant, Martin Heidegger, or a valley girl from Southern California. Oh yeah, I forgot. I got to do this real quick here. So. All right, good. So, just do that. Otherwise, this didn't happen. Memory is incredibly important. Think about Virgil's Aeneid. Right? Virgil and what I call the mythos, the myth of Rome, the creation of Rome, right? To create a culture, to create an empire, to create a kingdom, Virgil knew that memory played a tremendous role, right? When Aeneas comes to the river Lethe in book 6 of the Aeneid and he meets his dead father, kind of Hamletian, right? Meets his dead father Anchises down there in the underworld, and he sees this torrent of people that are flowing towards this exit that will take them back into the upper world. These are, of course, souls that have already existed and have died and have come down into the underworld, and are being prepared to go back and be reborn. And during that time, they're drinking from the river Lethe. So they forget everything that they've learned in their previous lives. That's why you're born, reborn in the Greek and Roman conception as a blank slate, a tabula rasa. And Aeneas is at the Lethe and he says, Dad, what are all these people doing here? His father Anchises explains. He says, and why are they all drinking from the river Lethe? What's the point of that? Now, Aeneas, of course, had lived before because they're all infinitely being recycled. And Aeneas doesn't know what the river Lethe does. Why? He forgot because he drank from it. So Aeneas has to ask what the river Lethe does. And so his father responds, and he says to him, and you have it in your notebooks there, I think. He says, these are souls to whom fate owes another body. And they come to the Lethe, and they're just blown out into oblivion, so their souls would be ready to leave Elysium and to go back into the painful life up above. How about the story of the shield of Aeneas? Of course, Aeneas is trying to do what everyone's been trying to do ever since Homer, which is he wants to beat Homer, right? Homer's the first great poet, right? And Aeneas comes along and says, well, I'm just going to outdo Homer, right? Yeah, good luck with that. And then after Aeneas, every poet is trying to beat, or after Virgil, every poet is trying to beat Virgil and Homer. And after a while, everyone is trying to beat Spenser and Dante and Virgil and Homer. And then Milton comes along. He's finally the first person that can actually do all of that. Everyone's been trying to outdo Milton ever since. And of course, no one will ever do that. Not unless maybe Homer is reincarnated, but we don't believe in that here. Right. So there's this shield. Remember, Aeneas gets this shield. His mother Venus has Vulcan make this shield, just like the shield of Aeneas. But on the shield is the history of Rome. But see, Aeneas hasn't gone up the Tiber yet. He hasn't been the founder of Rome. None of these people have been born yet. Romulus and Remus, they're not there. The she-wolf, she hasn't even been born yet. Right? Octavius, he's not born yet. Julius Caesar, the Battle of Actium, none of these things have happened. But what happens is Vulcan creates this beautiful shield for Aeneas, and Aeneas is this beautiful long description how he's just wowed by it, because the shield is a prophecy of everything that's going to happen in the empire, that he is going to become the founder. It's a future memory. It's a memory of the future history of Rome. Do we give shields like this to our students? We'll read this beautiful passage in Fagel's wonderful English translation, or maybe in Latin. But do we give our students shields like that? Do we say, you, if you are a believer, you possess a shield, the shield of faith, we call it Paul in Ephesians. Do we give them shields? Which, like the shield of Aeneas, when you're fighting Aeneas, like Turnus at the end of book 12, you're fighting against a foe who's coming at you bearing a shield, and the shield is a picture of the future of his victory. Do you give your students a shield like that? Do you give your students a shield like that? Memory is very important. Even memory of the future is important, isn't it? Right? And despite the fairly wide range of evangelical theology in this room, and I said this the other day in one of my talks, and probably quite wide range, particularly of eschatology, how does everything wind up? Despite that, we all share the same basic eschatology, which is, in the end, God wins. Right? If you're Amil and you find yourself in the middle of the rapture, you say, oh no, Jesus, I'm not going, I'm Amil. If you're pre-trib, post-middle, whatever, and then you find yourself, you know, in the amillennial non-kingdom, you're not going to go, oh no, absolutely not, God. You're going to be like, yay, we won, God wins. Right? Do you give your kids this kind of shield? Even the pagans knew that future memory was incredibly powerful. It could build kingdoms. Now, the only important literary writer, John Milton. You probably know the story of Cupid and Psyche, right? Cupid, you know, Venus's cute little boy. He's always got the blindfold on, the bow and arrow. He's got the blindfold on because he's always shooting the wrong people. You ever notice all the wrong people always fall in love? Right? When people come to me or come to my wife and I for counseling about, you know, we're having some trouble in our marriage. I said, well, yeah, welcome to being married. You know, it takes some work. And they're like, well, I married the wrong person. Well, they're the right person now. Right? Solve it. I mean, when you have insoluble marital difficulties, and we've been married now for a third of a century, when you have insoluble marital difficulties, you have three options. Work it out, or work it out. Those are your options, right? If God can work it out with us, through His inestimably beautiful grace, then He gives us the grace to work out our own sinful differences. I mean, marriage is actually quite insane. You take two sinners and you squash them into one flesh sinner, you know? So Cupid falls in love with Psyche, but Psyche is immortal, and he's an immortal, and that's kind of a no-no, unless you're kind of one of those Zeus pervert gods or something like that, right? So he falls in love with Psyche, and of course she gets in trouble. She's offended the gods, so she's, you know, dies and set down the underworld, and she's given a task, and her task is to divide this giant pile of seeds, black seeds, white seeds, a whole bunch of seeds all mixed up. Her task is to divide the seeds. This is Antonio Canova's, I think it's the greatest sculptor of the 18th century, beautiful, beautiful Italian sculptor, Canova. I think this is the most beautiful sculpture, one of the two or three most beautiful sculptures in the world, his Cupid and Psyche. And Milton, in his Areopagitica, written in June of 1644, uses the image of Psyche and the seeds to describe the process of discernment that is so absolutely necessary for a person to become a wise Christian. I'm not going to go into a tremendous amount of detail about Areopagitica. You can read about it in a kind of a short chapter in my little book, which I think you guys gave away for free here last year at this conference. Is that right? There's a commentary on the value. I'm not sure. But Milton reminds us that good and evil grow up in this world together, completely woven around one another. It's almost like they're two trees that grew up together and their bark just rubbed and they grafted themselves together. They're like two plants that grew up and they've just intertwined. It's like the wisteria that grows up around your oak tree or the ivy on your elm. And they almost become one, good and evil in this fallen world. They grow up together and it's almost impossible to separate them without destroying both. And he picks up this metaphor, as he so often does, this classical image of Cupid and Psyche. He says the seeds of Psyche were not more intermixed. Right? So picture Psyche on this vast plain in the underworld, and she's given this huge pile of seeds, half of them white seeds, half of them black, and some versions of them admit they're caraway seeds. It doesn't really matter. And her job is to separate out the seeds, black pile, white pile. Black pile, white pile. Little tiny seeds all day long. And when she's finally got it all done, the whirlwind comes in and throws them back together. He says that's what it is like for us to try and fully differentiate and separate out good from evil in this world. And Areopagitica, you're probably well aware, is an anti-censorship argument. Yes, First Amendment, anti-censorship, intellectual, historical theory comes from John Milton, a Puritan. People have entirely the wrong idea about Puritans in all kinds of ways, by the way. And so he says, we are like Psyche. We would desperately love to divide out every good book from every bad book and just keep the good. We would love to be able to make every fine moral and intellectual and theological distinction. But in the fallen world, it's futile. And as he builds a series of metaphors in this famous paragraph here, he refers to Jacob and Esau, and Psyche, and Genesis 3, and the apple. And his point is this. Discernment is always a division. You're always separating out one thing from another. And in this life, it's not complete. And this is why you will always have some difficulty with students and with parents and with yourself when you deal with content, particularly when you're dealing with pagan content. But you will never, ever become wise until you learn how to work through the lifelong process of separating out good. Are there good things in Aristotle? Yes. Bad things in Aristotle? Yes. Plato? Yes. Aquinas? Yes. Luther? Yes. Luther, the father of the Reformation, was, at least later in his life, a pretty hateful anti-Semite, and he wrote some things which are difficult to read. Jews should be thrown from their houses, their goods confiscated, and they should be put to work with shovels. That's Martin Luther. That's not one that people like to put on their refrigerator. Oh, Luther in table talk. Hate the Jews. Take their stuff. Give them shovels. See, the only text, the only cultural object that we have that is absolutely perfect and pure without error is the Scripture. And that becomes our grid through which we read and understand everything. The problem is that we forget this and we become self-righteous little pea brains thinking that we can separate out everything, including our brethren. Oh, this one is that and that one is the other. The problem, you see, is that we have fallen. I love Bruegel's beautiful picture of, I'm just going to go ahead through here. Bruegel's beautiful painting here of, it looks like a painting just of paradise, but if you look very carefully from the far left, the recesses, all these animals jumping around and playing. You see Adam and Eve next to a tree having a conversation with a snake. All the animals don't realize that they're all about to become, well, most of them, meat. And Milton has this beautiful line in Paradise Lost, which is great art. If you have not read it, you need to read it. There's this beautiful set of lines in Paradise Lost in Book 4 where he's describing, he's trying to describe paradise. And he says, "And country whereof here needs no account, but rather to tell how, if art could tell." Now this is fabulous. He says, I'm going to describe for you poetically the poetic truth, the visualized poetic truth of the Garden of Eden, of paradise, of perfection. But I don't really need to tell you about that. Now why would he say that? I think he says that I don't really need to tell you about it because you already know. It's the place you long for. It's where you want to live. It's where you want to go. It's where you want to be. It's where you wish you were now. It's what you miss. It's what you pine for. It's what you ache for. You have what I like to call an Edenic memory. Everyone is born with a depraved soul, but imprinted on that depraved soul is a memory of what you've lost. You were born without it, but you lost it. And we have this aching desire for it. He says, "And country whereof here needs no account, but rather to tell how, if art could tell." See, Milton, you have to understand, Milton is like a 9-digit IQ mega genius. Okay? And he's doing something in Paradise Lost that is so insanely crazy and cocky. Who would ever dare to say, "I will justify the ways of God to man"? God's like, "Yeah, thanks, I really needed help with that." But Milton had his long red hair and his little Puritan hat, and he was like, "Okay, I'm a genius, I'm going to try it anyways." But he knows as he tries to describe Eden, how can I do this with all of my art? Probably the best educated, best read writer in the 17th century, the century of genius. Says, if art could tell. See, I think all art is a looking back to Eden. All culture is a looking back to Eden. When Plato wrote all those Socratic dialogues, tried to figure out how to create a perfect republic, tried to figure out in Euthyphro what piety was, and so on and so forth, all of that. That's just him responding to the echo of Eden in his mind, trying to recreate what he lost that he never had. If art could tell. I mean, Bruegel is a fabulous, fabulous painter, but even he can't begin to capture the glories and the beauty of Eden. So Milton says, "I can't do it," and then I'm going to do it for a couple hundred lines. "How from that sapphire fount the crisp brooks, rolling on orient pearl and sands of gold with mazy error under pendant shades, ran a nectar, visiting each plant and fed flowers worthy of paradise, which not nice art in beds and curious knots, but nature boon poured forth profuse on hill and dale and plain, both where the morning sun first warmly smote the open field and where the unpierced shade embrowned the noontide bowers. He's only halfway through a sentence here, by the way. Thus was this place a happy rural seat of various view, groves whose rich trees wept odorous gums and balm, others whose fruit burnished with golden rind hung amiable. Hesperian fables true, if true, here only. See, when he talks about Hesperian fables, that just includes all the myths, all the fairy tales, all the stories. And he says, if fairy tales were true, this would be the place they were true. All myths have their origin in Eden. This is why cultural anthropologists are like, oh, all religions are the same. They're all invented by people, right? Because all the myths and all the religions have these core things that they share. Maybe that's because all of humanity came from one pair in Eden. And we all share an Edenic memory of what we have lost. If true, here only, and of delicious taste, betwixt them lawns or level downs, and flocks grazing the tender herb, were interposed, or palmy hillock, or the flowery lap of some irriguous valley. Isn't it cool? Talk about people who invent words. Irriguous. An irrigated valley. As opposed to where I live in Southern California, where in my yard it has not rained for 7 years. I'm not kidding. 7 years. Dialing 1-800-ELIJAH, you know. Everything's dying here. Flowers of all hue. Aren't you glad God invented flowers? Aren't you glad that poets will describe the bucolic beauties of plants in the natural world? Flowers of all hues, and without thorn, the rose. And the granularity, particularity of Milton's detail. He imagines all the flowers, and then he imagines the rose. But in paradise, the rose has no thorn, because the thorn is pain. Does anything smell better than a rose? Is anything more beautiful than a rose? But then there's that thorn, and that is the reminder of the fall. Now, what's interesting, in book 9, you jump ahead 5 books, and, you know, Eve eats the fruit and everything. Adam, while Eve is having a conversation with the devil and eating the fruit and becoming a fallen woman, Adam's off there being a good little boy. Yoop, 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 yoop. Working in the garden, doing his stuff, not sinning at all. And then he's like, I miss my wife, just like I miss my wife. And those of you that are here without your spouse, miss your spouse, right? And he's like, I miss her. Oh, almost lunchtime. I got to go. Oh, I've been working on these plants here, and I've got this rose bush, and I'm going to make this wreath of flowers to give to Eve as a thank you and a welcome her back to lunch. And so in book 9, we get this. Thus Eve, now Eve has fallen. And she's like, where's that little Adam guy? I don't know. Should I give him some of this fruit and make him a god? Or rather, not. And keep the odds of knowledge power to myself. So she goes, yeah, but then if God finds that I did this and I die, then Adam will live. God will take another rib, make another Eve. I can't imagine him with it. Now, this is how insane jealousy is, right? She's jealous of another woman and there are no other people. Right? So, in an act of great charity and unselfishness, he snaps off a branch. I'll give it to him. Right? And so, she's walking with her branch of death fruit. Right? The apple that we've been eating ever since. What we don't know, and Milton gives a great line, right? She knew not eating death. She's eating an apple, but the apple is eating her. She's dying. And along comes Adam. You know, unfallen Adam. The perfect man. The man every woman in this room is dreaming of. And which none of the rest of us can possibly measure up to. Fortunately, if you're a believing lady, you do have a perfect husband named Jesus, right? Right. Second Adam. So Adam comes up and he's got his garland of flowers, you know, the rose without thorns. And she's got her broken off, you know, death fruit. And they're going to give each other a gift. Thus Eve, with countenance blithe, her story told. You know, Adam, I ate the fruit. That God guy, he lied. We didn't. But look, I'm not dead. But in her cheek, distemper flushing glowed. She's feeling guilt, but she's trying to hide it. So the guilty red face, she's trying to pass off as she's just blushing because she's so excited about seeing Adam. On the other side, Adam, soon as he heard the fatal trespass done by Eve, amazed, astonied stood and blank, while horror chill ran through his veins and all his joints relaxed. He slumps. His beautiful, perfect Eve is now a monster. From his slack hand, the garland wreathed for Eve, down dropped all the faded roses shed. Now, why do roses fade? Why do the petals fall off? This is a beautiful image. Here's Eve. Have some fruit. I got a vegetative offering for you. Here's Adam. I have a garland of roses for you. Roses without thorn. Why do rose petals fade and drop off? Because they die. Why do they die? They die because of the fall in the world. And so he slumps and he drops this garland. And the garland is laying on the ground in front of us. And this will show you Milton's subtlety. Because he stops short of describing what's actually now on the ground in front of him. If the roses have faded, and if the petals have dropped, what else is going on with the rose bush and what is now laying on the ground in between them? It's a crown of thorns. This is Milton's very subtle, beautiful, powerful allusion to Genesis 3:15, the proto-evangelium, the pre-gospel. The promise of the seed of the woman. Even as he curses them, he says, but the seed of the woman. And that becomes the central visual trope in books 10, 11, and 12. The end of Paradise Lost. See, that promise of the seed of the woman, and in Milton's book 9 of Paradise Lost, that crown of thorns in front of them, that is a future memory. It's a memory of the future. It's a promise, right? It's a promise. And that's what Poe Alethea is. Making the not forgetting. Making the not forgetting. Right? How many of you have forgotten something that you learned in school? I've forgotten most of it. In Paradise Regained, one of the great temptations that Satan offers to Jesus, because Paradise Lost is about how the first Adam lost Paradise in 12 books, and Paradise Regained is very, very short. It's 4 books, about 500 lines each, much, much shorter. And this is about how the second Adam, Christ, resists Satan. Adam falls in a garden. Christ obeys in the desert, and he resists the temptations that we see in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And Milton weaves this beautiful poetic image of this titanic cosmic battle in between Christ and Satan. And Satan tempts him with this and that and the other thing. And Milton, being a poet, kind of imaginatively expands the three temptations, which seem fairly simple in the Gospels. And he expands it this way and that way and the other way. And I want to draw your attention to one particular segment here, if I can get that slide back up there. At one point, sorry, Marco Rubio impression. Poor guy. Satan says, Jesus, how are you going to reach the people of the world unless you speak their language, unless you know their culture, unless you've watched their movies, read their books? How are you going to reach them unless you understand their culture? And Satan goes through and he gives this long, beautiful description of every philosophical and cultural system. He talks about Homer, and he talks about the rhetoricians, and he talks about the plays of Sophocles, and he talks about all the different kinds of cultural productions. People ask, how are you going to meet people? How are you going to reach people? Unless you know their stuff, unless you know their culture. Kind of sounds like us sometimes. Maybe. And so he goes through the whole history of philosophy, particularly human culture in general, but philosophy particularly. And then Jesus answers and he shows him two things. Number one, he says, you don't need any of that when you have the gospel. You don't need any humane learning at all. You don't need to know philosophy. You don't need to know literature. You don't need to know history. You don't need any of that. And then Jesus goes through and he reiterates at much greater length and much more detail and much more accurately the entire history of human cultural production, particularly in philosophy. In other words, he says, you don't need it, and I know it all anyways. And that's a good model for us. You don't need it, but you know it anyways. You don't depend upon it, but you know it anyways. And at the end of this long section, here's what Jesus says to Satan. And this is Jesus talking to the devil about reading. It's one of my favorite passages in all literary history. Jesus says, who therefore seeks in these, and in these are the ideas of human beings captured in books. Who therefore seeks in these true wisdom finds her not. Am I supposed to close my school down now? No. Who therefore seeks in these true wisdom finds her not, or by delusion far worse. You're not going to find wisdom here. You'll probably find falsehood. Her false resemblance only meets an empty cloud. However, many books, wise men have said, are wearisome. Who's he quoting? No, he's quoting himself because he wrote the Bible. But yeah, Solomon resists the amanuensis in a certain sense, right? Yeah, it's Hebrews. It's Ecclesiastes 12:12. However, many books, wise men have said, are wearisome. Who reads? We would say whoever reads. Whoever reads incessantly. Do you assign a lot to your students? I hope so. Yeah. The whole point of being a really good classical Christian teacher is to have your students right at the edge of despair most of the time. And then pull them back from the edge of the abyss. Right? So the way I design things at Trinity Classical Academy is we kill them for 4 years in high school, in the rhetoric school. Right? And they turn in their final draft of their senior thesis, which they will memorize over the next month and then present to a panel of, you know, judges and so on. They turn in their senior thesis, and then I put them on a plane and I take them to Italy for a week. And halfway through the week of walking around Florence or Venice or Rome, wherever, I say, does anybody remember what their senior thesis is about? And they're like, what's a senior thesis? Right. Okay. And so he says, can I get that back up there again? Whoever reads incessantly and to his reading brings not a spirit and judgment equal or superior. And what he brings, what needs he elsewhere seek? Uncertain and unsettled still remains, deep versed in books, shallow in himself. You ever met people like that? Yeah, if you went to graduate school, that's basically everybody. Crude or intoxicate, collecting toys and trifles for choice matters. Ooh, look at this line from Cicero. I'm going to put a bumper sticker on my car. This is wonderful. This is my life verse from the pagans, right? Something that's actually a trifle you think is something brilliant and wise. Worth a sponge. Doesn't mean it has equal monetary value to a sponge. It means it's worth sponging, which is the way they used to erase their boards in the 16th century. All pagan knowledge is actually worthy of being erased. Plato, Cicero, Epimenides, Lucretius particularly. Worth a sponge, as children gathering pebbles on the shore. Oh, look, mommy, a diamond. No, it's an old Coke bottle bottom. But when you're a child, when you're a fool, you can't tell the difference. So he says, you must bring to your reading a spirit and judgment equal or superior. How do you get judgment equal or superior to Plato, to Cicero, or Aquinas, for that matter, or Martin Luther? Well, he tells us here in a number of other places, by reading widely, and reading wisely, and reading everything very carefully in terms of Scripture. he continues on and he tells the devil, who's backing off now and tearing up his library card now, not really. Jesus says, or if I would delight my private hours, because isn't reading delightful? It's just such a lovely thing to be able to just sit and read and think. Or if I would delight my private hours with music or with poem, where so soon as in our native language can I find that solace? All our law and story strewed with hymns, right? The law and the narrative parts of the Old Testament. All our law and story strewed with hymns, our psalms with artful terms inscribed. You know who wrote the most beautiful poetry of all? David. Yeah. This is what Jesus says. In Babylon that pleased so well our victor's ear, declare that rather Greece from us these arts derived. There's always been all these stories floating around in the ancient world that the Hebrews got all their wisdom from the Egyptians, or that the Christians got all of their ideas from the Greeks. And Jesus says, no, because Milton's a classical Christian humanist scholar. And he knows that all wisdom and all knowledge, ultimately, even that of the pagans, comes from God, even if it's the suppressed truth that always bubbles back into cultural production. He says, the Greeks stole their stuff from us. Maybe not directly from the Jews, but all of their knowledge and wisdom they got from God. You know, at the end of his life, Plato comes to the point where he's really kind of a monotheist and a very strong ethicist. I mean, he almost would pass as a Christian, except he's not. He's very close in many, many ways. Right? Calvin, in the opening of the Institutes, repeatedly refers to Cicero as the eminent pagan. He doesn't say a pre-Christ Christian, he just says the eminent pagan. He says the same thing about Plato while still critiquing him. Okay? And let me get my text back up there. Never turn Milton off. This is not good. Okay. And he says, ill imitated while they loudest sing. These are the pagans. They have ill imitated us. Ill-imitated while they loudest sing the vices of their deities and their own in fable, hymn, or song. This is what the pagans do. They sing about their gods. Right? Ever read that really wholesome book by Ovid called The Metamorphoses? That's the most fun thing to teach to ninth graders. Because I taught ninth grade there when I was building the high school at Trinity. And I would have them, you know, I would have them start reading like the Myth of Python. And I'd get halfway through it in Latin with them and I'd leave the room. Come back and they're all bright red, you know. Did we translate this correctly? Yes, you did. Isn't that embarrassing? These people are pagans. Do not act like this. Right? They sing the vices of their deities and their own people. Right? Homer writes of Hector and Achilles and so on and so forth. In fable, hymn, or song, so personating their gods, ridiculous, and themselves past shame. Is there any part of Scripture that better describes both the ancient pagan world and the modern world than Romans chapter 1? You're watching it. It's being fulfilled in front of your eyes. Not only do they sing their vices and the vices of their gods ridiculous, but they are past shame and they are beyond being ashamed of their shame. They hang flags. And I love this line, their gods, ridiculous, right? The Romans picked on the Egyptians by saying, your gods are ridiculous. You got this dog-headed guy, what's his name, Anubis, and then you get this alligator dude, and you got, I'm sorry, if you're a Roman, you cannot pick on the Egyptians for their gods being ridiculous. And he continues along. And here's his critique of pagan literature. This is from a guy who read, because I've got a couple of my former Milton students in here. What did Milton read? Everything. The scholars are still trying to track down if there was anything that he apparently did not read that was available in the 17th century, because he quotes and alludes to, in Paradise Lost alone, he quotes, references, or alludes to, or paraphrases 1,500 authors, not works, authors, as in Aristotle is one author. 1,500. And did I neglect to mention to you? He was blind.
And here's his critique of classical literature. Maybe one of the greatest classicists of all time. Maybe the greatest classicist of all time. He says, remove their swelling epithets, thick laid as varnish on a harlot's cheek. The rest, thin sown with aught of profit or delight. This guy spent his entire life reading. He burned his eyeballs out reading. Went blind 10 years younger than what I am right now. The height of his powers, his brilliant scholar and writer goes blind. And now he says, when I look back at everything I read, I realize that it is like too much makeup on a prostitute's cheeks. Talk about a life analysis, midlife crisis, right? Thin sown with aught or profit or delight. It's not that there's no profit, there's no delight, just like exercise. Exercise profits a little, you should do it. Will be found unworthy to compare with Zion songs to all true tastes excelling. The test of your taste is not if you prefer Cicero to Seneca, but if you know that Scripture is on an entirely different plane. As far as both the rhetoric and the theological truths. Where God is praised or right, and godlike men, the holiest of holies, and what's the holiest of holies? Godlike men. Milton talks about the only way that you can be a true poet is to be a good man. The Holy Spirit dwells not in temples made by hand, but he dwells in pure hearts. If you're a believer and you follow God, you are a holy of holies. You are a dwelling place of God. And he says, the godlike men, the holiest of holies, and his saints, such are from God inspired, not such from thee, unless where moral virtue is expressed by light of nature, not in all quite lost. Right? That's Calvin's doctrine of common grace, by the way. Yeah, pagan stuff is not as great as a lot of people think it is, but there are some moral truths in there, but that's only because of what God has built into you by the light of nature, the truth that you have suppressed, which still comes out, even if you're Sophocles and you write plays about guys who kill their father and sleep with their mother. No wonder even the Greeks were grossed out by that, because everybody knew it was wrong. That was what drew the pity and the horror and caused the catharsis in the audience, the purging of pity and fear. So what do we need? If all this stuff you have your students read is of thin value, what do we need? We need to have our senses and our students' senses fully recalibrated towards the good and the true and the beautiful. When I was young, I hated school. I got kicked out of college when I was 18 years old. I hated school, because I was given a stream of junk to read. And the good stuff I read, I didn't get it because my taste had not been developed. I did not know what good food tasted like because I had been eating junk food. And even when I had a good teacher, and I had a few great teachers along the way, even when I had a good or a great teacher, I was at that point a lost cause because I had not been invested in properly. So we need a full recalibration of our senses towards the good and the true and the beautiful. And that's why classical schools unapologetically focus on the best, the greatest, the most beautiful. Not the ugly because it's trendy. Not the horrific because it's cool. And we have to teach ourselves and teach our students to remember that our hermeneutic grid is always nothing more or less than the Scripture. It is the book by which all other books are judged. I'm not superstitious, but I never, ever, ever set my Bible on the floor. And I never put any other book, and I own thousands of books, I never put any other book on top of my Bible. And it's just, it's not superstition, it's just, you know, it's just a reminder to me that nothing is above it. It's the hermeneutic grid by which we judge everything. By which we judge everything. It's the final arbiter of everything. Can I get that slide back up there? There we go, thank you. And all of this is because Scripture tells us what the true nature of the soul is. Our soul is depraved. Not only Calvinists are born depraved, everybody's born depraved, right? We're born fallen. We're born depraved, as Martin Luther said, and he's quoting a bunch of other people, of course. No one's original. He says, "Cor incurvatus ad se," our heart is curved inwards towards ourselves. I'd say this beautiful, reflexive, horrible, reflexive image. Our heart, our core is incurved towards ourselves. We're bent into ourselves. We think we're so open and expansive and free and brilliant and beautiful. But in fact, we're curled inward. We're like a mirror that is a globe with the mirror on the inside. And there is nothing to reflect but darkness. It's a reflection of a reflection of a reflection of nothing. That is what our hearts are like when we are born. Cor incurvatus, I'd say. And what do we need? What do we need? What do our students need above all else? We need conversion. Your lesson plan is simple. Conversion of your students. They have to be converted. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. Do not forget this. Poe aletheia. Making the not forgetting. Do not forget this. Do not forget this. Do not forget this. If you forget this, that your lesson plan is conversion. If you forget this, then every lesson plan you make, every senior thesis that you guide, every third grade Latin chant that you work through, every memorization project of the presidents in fifth grade, and your senior trip grand tour of Europe, all of these things, if you forget Poe aletheia, that your lesson plan is conversion, all of those other things will be a waste of time. Resources. An opportunity. We must not produce educated, clever pagans who will take the weapons that we give them and turn them back upon the church. This is the inherent danger of educated Christians. The uneducated Christians, the barbarian Christians, they're dangerous too, but in a different way. Your lesson plan is gospel first. Remember, you are forming souls. You are forming souls. In which direction will you form them? You do not want to make goats who get in line with the sheep at the last day because they think there's something they're not. I'm sure you all are well aware of C.S. Lewis's famous sermon, The Weight of Glory. Here's what Lewis said. The load or weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. Do you think of your students this way every day? To remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. Or else, a horror, a corruption, such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. That's what every one of your students is. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities. Don't ever say, I'm just a teacher. Don't ever say that. Don't ever say, I'm just a kindergarten teacher. And let me say publicly, can we stop using the term lower school? Nothing lower about it. It's the foundation. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them that we should conduct all our dealings with one another. All friendships, all love, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. They don't exist. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. Your students are fallen, and more than education, they need redemption. The classical Christian education movement is a part of how our great God is calling them home. So give them a hunger for Eden by giving them a taste of the good and the true and the beautiful, by creating in them an unforgettable poe aletheia, the making of the not forgetting. Don't forget it. Thank you.